Let's be on our guard against thinking.
That is quite the opening line to a philosophy lecture, isn't it?
It is absolutely wild.
Yeah.
I mean, usually, you know, you go to a philosopher to learn how to think. You expect some structure, logic, maybe a solid syllogism or two.
Right. You expect them to give you the tools to figure things out.
Exactly. But today, for this deep dive, we are jumping into a stack of lecture notes from Dr. Arthur Holmes. And he's basically telling us that everything you think you know is a trap. And the tool you're using to figure it out.
Your brain.
Yeah, your brain might just be lying to you.
Or at the very least, it's not doing what you actually think it's doing.
Right. So welcome back to the deep dive. Today we are tackling the heavy hitter himself, Friedrich Nietzsche. But we aren't just doing the standard biography. We're not doing the mustache or the syphilis.
We are looking at his will to power, his absolute demolition of the concept of objective truth, and how he basically paved the road for the modern kind of confused world we live in right now.
It really is a direct line. I mean, if you look at the culture wars today, if you look at how people argue that everything is just a power struggle, or that there's no such thing as objective facts.
Only your truth and my truth.
Yes, exactly. That entire road starts right here with Nietzsche. But, and here's the twist I really didn't see coming when I started looking through these sources, the second half of our deep dive today is a literal cloak and dagger spy story.
It sounds totally made up, like fiction.
We have a Catholic priest smuggling papers across a border in the dead of night to save the work of a Jewish philosopher from the Nazis.
And the incredible irony there is that the work he was saving was a specific attempt to rescue the concept of truth from the exact damage that Nietzsche did.
That would be Edmund Husserl and the birth of phenomenology. It's the perfect counterweight to our story. We go from the total destruction of foundations with Nietzsche to this desperate search for solid ground with Husserl. So our mission today is to trace that arc.
Right. We have to start with the demolition. To understand the rescue mission, you really have to understand the disaster first.
And the source material paints a picture of Nietzsche's universe that is, well, it's pretty bleak. I think we all know the famous quote, right? God is dead. It's printed on a million t-shirts.
True, but Holmes points out something very specific about that quote in his lecture. It isn't just a basic theological statement. Nietzsche uses this metaphor of the Buddha to explain the aftermath of that realization.
Oh, right, the shadow in the cave.
Yes. He says that long after the Buddha was dead, people still showed his shadow in a cave, this immense, frightful shadow.
So even if the deity is gone, the shadow is still just hanging around.
Exactly. That shadow represents our intellectual and cultural habits. Even if Western civilization stops believing in a literal deity, Nietzsche says we still desperately cling to the things that religion provided for us.
Like the idea of an objective order to the universe.
Yes, or universal morality. The comforting idea that the universe fundamentally makes sense and has some ultimate purpose.
Basically, we want the comfort of the house without actually having the foundation anymore.
Precisely. And Nietzsche is looking at all of us and saying, you haven't finished the job. You are still living in the shadow. To be truly free, you have to vanquish the shadow too. You have to admit what the universe actually is.
And what it is, according to the notes, is pure chaos.
Pure chaos for all eternity.
Holmes highlights this passage where Nietzsche warns us against thinking the universe is a machine. Because since the Enlightenment, since Isaac Newton, we love to think of the universe as a giant clock, right?
Right, with laws of physics, cause and effect, everything ticking along perfectly.
But Nietzsche says no. That is just us projecting our own human need for order onto a complete mess.
He says there are no laws of nature. There are only necessities. There is no one commanding anything, and there's no one obeying. It is just stuff happening.
He even says we shouldn't think of the world as creating beauty or form. He calls those aesthetic humanities.
We make those up to feel better.
It's like looking at a cloud and seeing a bunny rabbit, and then fiercely insisting that the cloud is actually a bunny rabbit. And Nietzsche is the guy screaming at you, it's just water vapor. Stop lying to yourself.
That is the perfect analogy. He wants to totally strip away the bunny rabbit.
Yeah.
He wants you to stare directly at the water vapor, the chaos, and not blink.
Which brings me to something that really surprised me in the research. I always assumed Nietzsche was big on evolution. You hear about survival of the fittest, the Superman, all that. It sounds just like Darwinism.
It does sound like it on the surface.
But the source material says he absolutely rejected Darwin.
This is a critical distinction that Dr. Holmes makes, and a lot of people miss it entirely. Nietzsche is an evolutionary naturalist, meaning he believes we are just biological beings. We are just animals. But he hated Darwin's specific mechanism.
Why, though? Darwin seems like he would be right up Nietzsche's alley. The strong survive, the weak perish.
Because Darwinism is too passive for Nietzsche. Think about natural selection. What does it actually reward? It rewards adaptation.
Just fitting into your surroundings.
Exactly. If the environment gets cold, you adapt and grow fur. If the trees get tall, you adapt and grow a long neck. You are constantly changing yourself to fit into the box the environment gives you.
And to Nietzsche, that produces what he calls weak-willed conformists.
Right. You are just surviving by blending into the background, and Nietzsche never wants to blend in.
He believes in biological vitalism instead.
Yes, he sees life as this massive, creative, explosive force. It is not about adjusting to the environment. It is about overcoming the environment. It's about sudden outbursts of novelty.
So it's not so much survival of the fittest. It's more like domination of the strongest.
That is the will to power. It is very close to Henri Bergson's idea of creative evolution. Life is a force that aggressively pushes back against the universe. It shapes the world. It doesn't just passively react to it.
Okay, so we have a universe of pure chaos. We have life as this exploding force of will. Now we have to talk about the part that really hurts my brain. What happens to logic? Because if the universe is chaos, logic seems completely out of place.
Oh, logic is gone. Or rather, it gets heavily demoted.
Demoted to what?
Holmes takes us through Nietzsche's genealogy of logic. He asks, where did human reason actually come from? We usually think logic is this high, abstract ability to see the objective truth of the cosmos.
But Nietzsche says logic originated from the illogical?
Yes. Think about early humans. Imagine the early humans who stopped to carefully contemplate the truth of a situation. The one who says, is that really a lion over there in the brush? Let me suspend judgment, gather more empirical data, and analyze the silhouette before I react.
The guy gets eaten.
He's lunch. The ones who survived were the ones who made rapid, snap judgments. Big shape equals danger, run. Even if they were wrong half the time, the impulse to decide quickly, to affirm a belief rather than carefully deny it, that is what actually kept them alive.
So what we call reason isn't some noble pathway to universal truth. It is just a fossilized survival instinct.
It is a weapon. Holmes quotes Nietzsche saying, and this is a sentence that should really stop you in your tracks, the falseness of an opinion is not for us an objection to it.
That completely breaks the rules of any debate. The falseness is not an objection.
It means the only question that matters to him is the opinion life-furthering? Is it species-preserving? We need logical fictions to live. If we actually saw the raw chaos of the universe exactly as it is, we would go insane. We couldn't function.
So we create these truths, like mathematics, logic, cause and effect, just to survive.
But they aren't true in an objective sense. They are just incredibly useful.
If I believe that eating a specific berry gives me magical superpowers, and that belief makes me confident enough to fight off a wolf, Nietzsche doesn't care if the berry actually has vitamins or magic. He just cares that the belief helped me fight the wolf.
Exactly. Truth is purely instrumental. It's a tool we created, like a hammer or a spear. You don't ask if a hammer is true. You ask if it works.
But wait, this raises a massive logical problem, and Dr. Holmes brings this up in the lecture notes. If Nietzsche is writing a book telling us there is no truth, is that statement true?
The liar's paradox. It is the classic philosophical trap. It's like the man from Crete who says, all Cretans are liars. Is he telling the truth? If he is, then he's lying. If he's lying, then he's telling the truth.
Right. So if Nietzsche says nothing is true, then his own sentence isn't true, which means something out there might be true. It feels like he just defeats himself instantly.
A traditional logician would say yes, his argument is completely incoherent. But Holmes points out that if you asked Nietzsche that question, he would just have a good belly laugh.
He wouldn't even care.
Not at all. He would say, you poor thing, you are still trapped in the web of logic. I am not trying to be logically consistent with you. I am asserting my will. He is not debating you. He is trying to overpower your perspective with his own.
That is incredibly frustrating. It's like arguing with someone who just flips the chessboard over and declares victory because they are physically stronger than you.
That is exactly what he is doing. He is telling you to wake up from the sickness of needing to be factually right and instead just be strong.
Which leads us directly into his views on morality. Because if truth is just a tool and logic is just a survival instinct, then good and evil must just be more tools.
Precisely. Holmes quotes him directly. There are no moral facts.
No moral facts at all.
None. Morality is merely an interpretation or a misinterpretation of phenomena. When you say stealing is wrong, you aren't stating a fact about the universe like water is wet. You are just venting an emotion.
This is the concept of emotivism mentioned in the notes.
Yes. Moral judgments are semiotic. They are signs. They are symptoms of your own internal state. If you value pity, mercy, and hesitation, Nietzsche sees that as a symptom of nervous weakness. It's a literal sickness to him.
You are just trying to protect yourself with morality because you are weak.
Exactly. But if you value strength and assertion, then you are healthy. You are expressing your will to power. Nietzsche absolutely roasts philosophers like Kant and Spinoza on this exact point.
Oh, I love that part in the source material. He talks about old Kant in his Tartuffery.
Tartuffery means hypocrisy. He thinks they are total fakes. Kant builds this elaborate, rigid system of categorical imperatives and mathematical logic. Nietzsche says it's all just hocus pocus to hide their own emotional drives. They're trying to make their personal preferences look like universal laws. Nietzsche just rips the mask right off.
So to recap the demolition phase here, we have a universe of chaos. We have logic that is just a survival instinct. And we have morality that is just us venting our feelings. This sounds exactly like the modern internet.
It really does.
It sounds like every comment section I have ever read.
Yeah.
Everyone just venting emotions and trying to assert dominance over each other.
And that is absolutely no accident. Holmes connects this directly to what we now call postmodernism.
Right. The source material explicitly links Nietzsche's work to the radical postmodernism of the late 20th century. But how exactly do we get from a guy with a mustache in the 1800s to modern campus politics?
It's all about what Holmes calls the substructure of thought. He groups Nietzsche with two other historical giants, Freud and Marx.
The unholy trinity of suspicion.
You could certainly call them that. Think about what they all have in common. They all claim that rational thought is a complete lie. Freud says you think you are being rational, but you are actually driven by your subconscious, your Oedipus complex, your repressed desires.
Marx says you think you are being rational, but you are actually driven by your material conditions, your class, the economy.
And Nietzsche says you think you are being rational, but you are actually driven by your will to power. They all agree that reason is just a puppet. There is a hidden, irrational puppeteer pulling the strings behind the scenes.
And if reason is just a puppet, then we can't really debate anymore, can we? I can't change your mind with facts if your mind is just a tool for your power.
No. And that is the crucial link to the modern university that Holmes points out. If there is no objective truth, if everything is fundamentally just an expression of power, then education isn't about learning the truth anymore. It becomes about politicization.
It just becomes a battleground.
Right. It becomes about asserting the will to power of your specific interest group. If logic is just a tool of the oppressor or a tool of the weak, why bother using logic? Just exert your power. Holmes mentions Alan Bloom's book, The Closing of the American Mind. Bloom complained that students had completely lost the ability to distinguish between true and false, and he traced it straight back to these continental thinkers.
It's a very heavy critique. It basically says that Nietzsche broke our ability to have a shared reality with each other.
And that is why the next part of our story is so important, because not everyone just accepted this breakage. Some people looked at this abyss Nietzsche opened up and said, we need to build a bridge.
Enter Karl Jaspers.
Karl Jaspers is sort of the middleman here. He was an existentialist himself, but he felt Nietzsche went way too far. He thought Nietzsche created too big a gap between the inner life of the will and the empirical world of science and facts.
He proposed three levels of being, right?
Yes. Dasein, which is just empirical existence, your biological self. Then consciousness, which is your rational enlightenment mind.
Yeah.
And finally, spirit, or Geist, which is your cultural creativity. Jaspers argued that an authentic life has to integrate all three of those. You can't just be a will to power monster, and you can't just be a cold logic robot. You need the whole integrated package.
But Jaspers is really just the warm-up act for the real rescue mission we teased at the start.
Yeah.
We need to talk about the cloak and dagger story.
This is one of those incredible moments where the entire history of philosophy hinges on a single car ride.
Set the scene for us. We are in the late 1930s.
The late 30s. Edmund Husserl has just died. Husserl was the father of phenomenology, which we will explain in a second, but more importantly for the historical moment, he was of Jewish descent living in Germany. And the Nazis are in power. They are actively coming to seize and destroy all of his papers.
His entire life's work is about to be erased from history.
Enter Father Hermann von Breda. He is a Catholic priest and a former student. He hears about this raid, rushes to the house, and manages to secure thousands of pages of Husserl's manuscripts, many of them written in complicated shorthand stenography. He packs them into a car or arranges the covert transport. The historical accounts vary slightly on the exact logistics, but the effect is the same. He smuggles them across the border into Belgium.
To the University of Louvain.
A very traditional Catholic university. And because of that one brave act, Louvain became the global center of phenomenological study. It influenced entire generations of thinkers, including, and the notes mention this explicitly, the future Pope John Paul II.
That is just wild to think about. You have a philosophy designed to save the concept of objective truth, created by a Jewish thinker, saved from the Nazis by a Catholic priest, which then goes on to influence a pope, all to fight back against the nihilism of Nietzsche.
History really does make for strange bedfellows.
So what was actually in those smuggled papers? What is phenomenology, and how does it fix the massive mess that Nietzsche made?
Well, Husserl's main enemy was naturalism, or what he called psychologism.
Psychologism? What does that mean exactly?
It is exactly what Nietzsche was doing. It's the idea that logic and truth are just psychological impulses, that they are just brain chemistry or evolutionary survival instincts. Husserl hated that idea. He said, no, 2 + 2 = 4 isn't just a survival trick. It is universally true whether human beings exist to think about it or not.
He wanted foundations.
He wanted absolute foundations, a new foundationalism. His famous slogan was getting back to the things themselves.
To the things themselves. But what does that actually look like in practice?
It is a specific method. Husserl believed that we naturally look at the world through layers of dirt. Our scientific theories, our psychological biases, our cultural assumptions. He wanted a method to strip all of that away. He called it bracketing.
Like putting mathematical brackets around the parts of an equation you don't want to solve just yet?
Exactly like that. If you bracket out your assumptions, if you stop assuming the world is a giant machine or a biological power struggle or a religious creation, and you just examine the pure structure of your own consciousness strictly enough, he believed you could find undeniable objective truths.
So unlike Nietzsche, who looks deep inside human nature and sees a chaotic world of power, Husserl looks inside and sees structure.
He sees a structure that absolutely guarantees meaning. He wants to anchor science and logic in something that cannot possibly be doubted. If Nietzsche is the guy blowing up the building with dynamite, Husserl is the guy trying to pour a new concrete foundation that is so incredibly strong nothing can ever blow it up.
But did he actually succeed? I mean, we are obviously still arguing about what truth is today.
That is the big question. Holmes notes that later philosophers like Heidegger and Sartre took Husserl's bracketing method, but actually dragged it right back toward the existential, subjective stuff. They liked his method, but they didn't really buy the absolute truth part. But the attempt itself, the mission to save truth from being reduced to just a tool of power, that formally starts with Husserl.
It is a battle that is clearly still happening. Just look around us. We are constantly debating post-truth, fake news, institutional power dynamics. It really feels like Nietzsche and Husserl are still fighting it out in the comment section of the internet right now.
They absolutely are. Nietzsche challenges us to see every single claim to truth as a hidden power grab. He asks us to be deeply suspicious of everything. Husserl challenges us to do the incredibly hard work of digging through our own bias to find solid, undeniable ground.
So what does this all mean for you listening to this? Why should you care about a couple of dead European philosophers?
I think it forces us to make a fundamental decision about how we want to live our lives. Are we comfortable living in Nietzsche's world? Are we okay with the idea that our deepest moral values are just vented emotions and our scientific truths are just survival tools?
It's a liberating idea in a way, isn't it? If nothing is true, everything is permitted, but it is also deeply terrifying.
It's terrifying because if there is no objective truth, there is only power. And if there is only power, then might makes right. The strongest person simply dictates reality. Husserl offers the vital alternative, that there is a solid ground out there, but you have to work incredibly hard to find it.
It's the difference between just surfing the chaos and trying to actually build an island.
That is a great way to put it. And looking at the state of the modern world, it seems like we are all just surfing right now.
Well, we have covered a massive amount of ground today, from the death of God to the death of objective truth, from the will to power to the frantic midnight smuggling of philosophical manuscripts.
It is a stark reminder that philosophy isn't just abstract people sitting in armchairs smoking pipes. These ideas shape world wars. They shape our universities, and they fundamentally shape how we talk to each other every single day.
Absolutely. And as we wrap up this deep dive, I want to leave you with a final thought to chew on, a little provocation, very much in the spirit of Nietzsche himself.
Go for it.
If Nietzsche's right, if all truths are just tools for survival, and every single human conversation is just an expression of the hidden will to power, then what exactly is this deep dive?
Oh, that is dangerous territory.
Think about it. Are we actually informing you? Are we sharing objective knowledge about the history of philosophy? Or are we just exercising our own will to power right now, trying to quietly shape your perspective to perfectly match ours?
And if you agree with the conclusions we've drawn today, did you decide that logically? Or did we just win the battle of wills?
It's something to think about.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe not think about, if you want to be on your guard. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive. We will see you next time.